Hey, everybody, it's Matt the Crankster Cranky.
And Chris, Hoth Ice Planet.
And we're the Sarlacc Pit Podcast, and you're listening to Jason and Carl in the Wampa's Lair
podcast. Whoa, Jason, Carl, who's that?
Yeah, Jason Hunt and Carl LeClaire, you know them, right? The Wampa's Lair podcast?
No, doesn't ring a bell.
Yeah, you remember Carl, we met him at Fan Days, he was on our show. And we actually got him over to Fan Days.
Really?
He was on our video show, and Jason was as well. Jason Hunt, Carl, no? Not ringing any bells?
Jason sounds a little familiar.
Well, anyway. Tell you what. Let's go there right now, and we'll have to listen to him. Go over to StarWarsReport.com and check out the Wampa's Lair podcast with Jason and Carl.
Welcome to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt, have been frozen upside down to the cave ceiling with nothing to do but talk all things Star Wars. So make yourselves comfortable, but keep a wary eye out for trouble. Here in the Wampa's Lair.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. This is episode 13, Obi-Wan Kenobi, part 2. I am one of your co-hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me is the maker of this illustrious podcast, we have Carl LeClaire.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. That was a little bit of a creepy introduction.
I'm sorry.
No. Creepy on my part, not yours. It's been almost 2 weeks now since we did our last show. So yeah. I've been missing the Wampa's Lair and missing my Jason Hunt action. So. I'm excited to be back at it, and we have a lot to talk about tonight, especially with the season finale of The Clone Wars and Darth Maul's return, and finishing up our episode on Obi-Wan, who's, you know, a wonderful character.
Exactly. However, before we get into that, we had a lightsaber duel.
We did, which I almost forgot about, which is pathetic, considering I made the pictures. I've been enjoying doing that. I'm sure our listeners have noticed I've been making little pictures on our Facebook page of all the lightsaber matchups. I try to get pictures that look really cool, and sometimes I do better than others, and I keep it pretty basic. I use paint on my computer at work to put them together, so it doesn't take too much effort, but I feel like it's a lot of fun to have a visual representation of the people we're talking about.
I like it. It gives it a bit more of a cooler dynamic, I don't know.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyways.
Anyway, yeah, let's get into it. So our duel from the past episode that we introduced was a master versus apprentice duel. We have Qui-Gon Jinn versus Count Dooku. And we got a few responses, quite a few responses once again, which is great. And Jason and I were just talking right before we sat down to start recording about we were pretty surprised with the feedback that we got. So Jason, I'm going to let you go ahead and read that feedback.
Alrighty, over on Facebook, Jesse Ariano writes in, says, "This is a tough one. Even though Dooku and Qui-Gon were friends, Qui-Gon never fought a Sith Lord except for Darth Maul, and even that tired him out. So regardless if it's Episode 2 or Episode 3 Dooku, Qui-Gon will lose the battle just because Dooku is a fast swordsman and powerful." Brian V. Klein, "Dooku would win. In just the movies, he has fought Yoda to a standstill, knocked Obi-Wan out of two fights, and defeated Anakin once. I wasn't that impressed with Qui-Gon's lightsaber work in The Phantom Menace, which is evident by his defeat at the hands of Maul, when he faced him one-on-one. Qui-Gon is a powerful Jedi Master in tune with the Living Force, but is just not as capable a swordsman as Dooku is." Patrick Kotef, I hope I pronounced that right, he says, "My vote goes to Count Dooku." Jazz, our Norwegian friend, says, "In addition to what has already been said, I could mention two quotes by Dooku that could shed some light on it. The first quote is, 'Master Kenobi, you disappoint me. Yoda holds you in such high esteem.'
Surely you can do better.
In my opinion, Obi-Wan has a much more skilled lightsaber fighter, is a much more skilled lightsaber fighter than Qui-Gon. And if Dooku thinks Obi-Wan is being as being an easy match, then Qui-Gon would be even easier for Dooku to beat. The second quote is,
"It is obvious that this contest cannot be decided by our knowledge of the Force, but by our skills with a lightsaber."
This seems to imply to me that Dooku, as strong as he may be in the Force, regards his lightsaber skills as his stronger side. And I believe I've read somewhere that Dooku was one of the most skilled lightsaber duelists in the Jedi Order before he left. As much as I love Qui-Gon, I think this one has to go to Dooku. Jason A. Moyles. Go Dookie! That was it. Over on Twitter...
That was deep. That was really deep right there.
It was very... Thank you. Thank you, Jason, for that deep insight. Over on Twitter, Leon355, a regular contributor to this segment. Dooku. A master never teaches the apprentice everything he knows. If Dooku can keep Yoda at bay, Qui-Gon Jinn shouldn't stand a chance. And as usual, we got an email from Lord Bruticus from the Dark Empire. Says, the way I see it, Qui-Gon would put up one heck of a fight, but not for long, against his old Jedi master. Qui-Gon died at the hands of another of Palpy's apprentices, and Dooku, being both a Jedi master and a Sith apprentice, well, I'd let logic dictate the outcome of that one, but that belongs to another Star franchise. I fancy the idea of Dooku telling Qui-Gon,
"You think I taught you everything? You are mistaken. Here's one final lesson."
And then he takes his angled blade and sneaks an impaling thrust through poor old Qui-Gon. Yeah, I really like that idea. Once a teacher, always a teacher. Straight through to the burning, bitter, pointy end. All the best. Joe, Lord Bruticus. TDE 021.
Added so much to that with your Christopher Lee voice, Jason. As always.
Thank you, thank you. One of my favorite voices to do, so, you know, when you have quotes, it just sort of has to come out. Well... what do you think, Carl? What is your take on our Qui-Gon versus Dooku matchup here?
Well, before I get in, I was really surprised as well to see that Dooku took, you know, swept it the way he did with our fan base. And this was a really hard one for me because I am a huge Qui-Gon Jinn fan. But after reading some of the responses of our listeners, as much as I hate to say it, I do think Count Dooku takes the upper hand. I love Qui-Gon. I think he's an excellent swordsman. And I think a few of our listeners downplay his importance. You know, just because he's defeated by Darth Maul doesn't mean he's nothing. Darth Maul is, you know, pretty handy with a lightsaber. And, of course, we haven't done a Darth Maul versus Count Dooku. But I even think that would be a closer fight than most people are willing to admit. However... as the master, I think Dooku does have the upper hand, and Dooku is much more in tune with his lightsaber ability. So I think he does have a little bit of the upper hand. I think it's going to be a very, very close fight, but at the end of the day, I think Count Dooku would win. So, and I hate saying that, because I absolutely love Qui-Gon. I don't think he would lose easily to Count Dooku, but as Count Dooku is the master, and you know, based on the fact that Count Dooku does fight Yoda Yoda definitely has the upper hand, but I think Count Dooku does very well against Yoda. And he's very, very old. So I think even in their primes, Count Dooku he's much more a gifted swordsman than Qui-Gon is. So I think that gives him a little bit of the upper hand. But, Jason, what do you think?
Oh, it looks like we're going to have another unanimous... vote here. I do like Qui-Gon, but I find Dooku just a fascinating character for some reason. Of course, it doesn't hurt that he's played by one of my favorite actors, so might be slightly biased there. However, biased or not, Dooku is an expert swordsman. He is a master of Form 2, which is Makashi, and that is the sword fighting technique. And in a day and age where most Jedi are fighting blasters, Dooku has trained for saber combat, and I think is just focus is so focused on his saber craft that he comes out victorious. Not to mention that he's proud enough and is too proud to let his apprentice beat him. So I'm going to have to make it a unanimous vote yet again.
Yeah, I was really surprised with this. I really thought it was going to be a lot closer. But I don't know. I mean, our listeners made some great arguments in comparison to Count Dooku. When I first set this thing up 2 weeks ago, it was in my head. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to pick Qui-Gon, no doubt about it. Maybe that was partly because of my bias towards Qui-Gon Jinn. But, you know, when I really thought about it and sat down and read some of the responses, I was like, you know what? Unfortunately, I think Count Dooku is going to be the better one here. So, I was a little surprised, but I do have to concede that point. However, I will say when it comes to Force adeptness, I think Qui-Gon takes the cake. I think Qui-Gon is far more adept to the Force than any character in the Star Wars universe. Just because he's not the most gifted warrior doesn't mean he's the most in tune with the Force.
Yeah, he's definitely much, much more in tune with the Force and is than most Jedi, I think. Because most Jedi have grown arrogant in the way that they use the Force, and so they just sort of reach out for it when they need it.
Right.
And whereas Qui-Gon...
more experienced ones.
Yeah. Yes, yes. But Qui-Gon just keeps throwing that in the Council's face. That's why he's not on the Council. So, you know, he's much more in tune with the Force, the living Force, and it's every whim and wave that it goes. So,
yeah,
I would have to agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for Count Dooku, the Force is, you know, his tool. He uses it. Whereas Qui-Gon is, you know, a recipient of it as opposed to a controller of it, which is why I respect him so much more. But again, Count Dooku is much more aggressive, much more adept with his blade. I think Qui-Gon uses his blade as a last resort, whereas Count Dooku sees it as another tool. So,
indeed.
But before we get into our wrap-up discussion here about Obi-Wan Kenobi, Jason and I wanted to, of course, talk about, you know, these last two episodes of The Clone Wars with the reemergence of Darth Maul. And, of course, that affects Obi-Wan a bit. And we're going to talk about that a little bit before we actually finish up our discussion. I'm sure a lot of other podcasts are going to be talking about these last two episodes. But I thought it'd be fun if Jason and I chimed in some of our own input. Because there were some interesting episodes, to say the least.
Yes, yes, they were. And I think I enjoyed them more than most people, it seems. So I haven't gone out and heard a lot of response on the latest episode, but I did see your comment on Facebook. So, but I think I enjoyed them more than, especially the first one. I heard a lot of backlash against the first episode with Savage's search for Darth Maul and that it was, you know, just, you know, he's on this planet looking for Darth Maul and that's it. And why is there a snake there and yada, yada, yada. And I'm just like, it's not bad. It's really not bad. You know, I don't think it's the best episode. I'm not going to say that at all, but I don't think it's a bad episode by any stretch of the imagination. And to be honest, Morley the snake doesn't bother me, you know?
Mm. Sure. Sure.
But
yeah, I'll jump in with my input on the two episodes, and then I'll let you finish because you're probably going to be a little bit more optimistic about it, if you will.
Okay.
I was really disappointed with both of the episodes. I'm not a huge fan of the Clone Wars to begin with, so maybe I'm not the best source. That's a topic for another show, but I was very skeptical of the return of Darth Maul to begin with, because he's dead, you know? I mean, Obi-Wan killed him. Why do we need to bring him back? That was kind of my reaction when I first heard it. I loved Darth Maul. I thought he was a fantastic character. The duel in Phantom Menace is, you know, I've said it a million times, it's my favorite duel in all of Star Wars. Darth Maul is a great, great character, but he was killed. So the fact that they bring him back in and of itself to me is stupid. And I know that's a bit harsh, so I apologize to those of you who really enjoyed this idea. But again, it goes back to my idea of canon, and I still have yet to listen to our brother show, Beyond the Films. I know they did an episode last week on personal canon. I keep meaning to sit down and listen to that, and I can't wait to listen to it, because I know Mark and Nathan both are going to have some great insight on that. But for me, it kind of goes to my issue that I have with the Return of the Jedi when they, removed Sebastian Shaw for Hayden Christensen. To me, I mean, that undid Anakin Skywalker's redemption. And to me, it undoes what Obi-Wan did. Obi-Wan defeated the Sith apprentice, and now all of a sudden he's alive. And I think they did a very poor job of explaining how he survived. They just kind of sidestepped that question. He somehow was able to survive. And when we first meet Darth Maul in that first episode, he's insane. And I really hated that. Darth Maul was this sinister, evil character who was very in control of himself in episode one. And now all of a sudden, he's this weird creature. Maybe to some extent, this is the result of his defeat. And he's kind of lost a bit of his sanity. So I appreciate that. But I think the character development of Darth Maul is, I lost a lot of respect for Darth Maul. I was no longer afraid of him after this new episode. In episode one, he's somebody to fear. And when he comes back in that first episode, he's kind of an imbecile. And in the second episode, it kind of annoyed me how he was able to best Obi-Wan. He hasn't practiced with a lightsaber in nearly 10 years from what it seems. And Obi-Wan's been fighting in the Clone Wars. He's become a far more adept warrior. And yet, he pretty much fights Obi-Wan to a standstill. And that really bothered me, because it makes Obi-Wan look kind of weak. And I think that's a little ridiculous. And Darth Maul should be, to begin with, he was a great warrior, but he was defeated by an apprentice. And now it's 10 years later, after he's lost his mind, all of a sudden he's able to best Obi-Wan, almost. And I found that ridiculous. So, personally, I didn't care for either episode. To begin with, I wasn't a big fan of bringing him back. But I did give in to the hype. It is Darth Maul. It's great to have him back. But once he came back, it was just so disappointing. The end of the episode, it was just weak. How long are they going to play this out now? They tease way too much out of the Clone Wars, in my opinion. So I was a bit disappointed. And I remember seeing a comment. I can't remember whose wall it was on. I think it was on the Dark Empire's Facebook wall when Lord Bruticus put up a picture from the episode of Darth Maul and Obi-Wan fighting. And somebody puts, spoiler alert, Obi-Wan wins again and Jesus Christ rises from the dead. They give these obvious responses, which I found very funny. Because we know, obviously, Obi-Wan's ultimately going to be victorious. Darth Maul is not in episode 3. He's obviously killed again. But I don't know. I think it's pushing too much. It's kind of Lucasfilm's attempt to satisfy every little fan craving, and I think it takes away from the story as opposed to gives to it. So that's my opinion. I was very disappointed in both the episodes.
I understand your point of view, however, I don't agree with it. This isn't the first time Darth Maul has been, quote unquote, brought back. There's been at least 3 times in the EU that somebody's, floated the idea, what would happen if Darth Maul survived somehow? So, obviously the most famous is the Visionaries comic, where he tracks Obi-Wan down after Revenge of the Sith on Tatooine, and he attacks the homestead, Owen and Beru Lars's homestead, and Obi-Wan has to come to the rescue before he kills Luke. And at the end of it, Obi-Wan doesn't have the heart to kill Maul when he's got him down. So Owen Lars blasts him through the head with a shotgun, basically. So this is just another interpretation or another idea of somebody bringing him back. And this is the first time that he's been brought back where it's can't just be cast off as well. That's just, you know, a what-if story, you know. So it's not like this is completely new, but in a sense, it's now we just can't, you know, say, well, that's just a great what-if story. Personally, I was very excited when I heard they were bringing Darth Maul back, because it's just always fun to bring back a great character like that, in my opinion. And I was really curious to see what kind of character development they were going to give him, because he's not much... there's not much to him in The Phantom Menace other than this very menacing, skilled warrior. But there's not much past that we see. I do think... I agree with you that they teased it way too early. And so the hype got completely out of hand before they actually were able to deliver. So in that aspect, the episodes were probably a little underwhelming. If they had teased it like Christmas or something like that, they announced it then I think it wouldn't have been quite as underwhelming as I think a lot of people found it to be. When we find Darth Maul, frankly, the fact that he's, you know, nuts and insane makes perfect sense to me, because he's, you know, half a man on a junk planet who's got nothing except his rage and hate of Obi-Wan to keep him alive for 10 years. Wouldn't you go a little insane too? I think the spider legs were a little peculiar. I don't think that was
much.
It was a little much. He didn't need to be Shelob, but I did like the with him insane, it made me more scared of him, because, you know, he's like insane and like, what's he gonna do next, you know, type of thing. Although Savage tempers that pretty quickly. Although it was cool to hear him muttering the Sith code in that first episode. But once he regains his sanity, thanks to Mother Talzin, and regains two legs, also thanks to Mother Talzin, which was interesting, because now Mother Talzin's more and more involved and wrapped up in this than we know, so that'll be interesting to see where they take her, and if we'll get revelations on how far she's actually involved with all of this later on. But I honestly didn't even, when you said that you were, you know, upset that he bested Obi-Wan after not using a lightsaber for 10 years, it didn't even really cross my mind when I was watching the episode. To be perfectly honest, I was just excited to see it happen. And I guess, you know, for Darth Maul, maybe, you know, I'm going to try to make an excuse here for him. He's got muscle memory from, you know, all of that, and he trained for probably, you know, up until he fought Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan as a living weapon, basically. So it's probably ingrained in him slightly, and, you know, who knows, it was a long trip to that planet. Maybe he sparred with his brother. Somebody, I think I saw on somebody's wall that mentioned that. But the duel between Darth Maul and Obi-Wan was really cool, because Darth Maul started getting under Obi-Wan's skin and taunting him, and Obi-Wan started losing control, which is part of why Darth Maul got the upper hand, which we'd never see from Obi-Wan. That was really interesting. But I'm curious to see where they take Darth Maul, because obviously he lived at the end of the episode, and we've been told he'll be back in Season 5, and I can't remember if they said Season 6, but at least Season 5. So I'm really curious and optimistic as to where they take him. I don't think it was the best season finale of the Clone Wars. I think Hostage Crisis from Season 1 is still my favorite season finale. And then this season finale is probably tied with the finale from Season 2. with the Boba Fett trilogy. But I think it was a good set of episodes. I liked seeing Asajj back and how she dealt with the brothers, but that's a topic for another day. But like I mentioned, unless do you have anything else you want to comment on before we transition into Obi-Wan?
Yeah, I mean, I will mention, I know I probably sound very, very harsh on the episodes, but I think, I feel like I'm sometimes the outcast from the broader Star Wars community where, you know, a lot of people love everything new that comes out, and maybe it's my sense of canon that makes me so, I don't want to say judgmental, but I just don't see the need for resurfacing characters that are dead. Just because they were, you know, loved by the fans doesn't mean you need to bring them back. But I will say there were a few things I did really enjoy from the episode. I loved watching Obi-Wan fight with Asajj's lightsaber. I thought that was so cool, seeing him with a red lightsaber. And, you know, then he comments, you know, red's not really my color. Or something of that nature. You know, that was pretty funny. I really enjoyed that. And I thought it was really cool how Asajj and Obi-Wan team up. I really like what they did at the end of the episode with Asajj's character's development. I really liked a lot of that. It's just, I really like Obi-Wan, and I think he's a very gifted saber duelist, and to just see this, you know, resurrected Darth Maul, who's, you know, essentially, yeah, maybe he sparred with his brother on the way there, but frankly, Savage, in my opinion, really doesn't stand up against Obi-Wan anyway. I mean, Obi-Wan is one of the leading duelists in the Order. Savage is a beast, just like Darth Maul was. And I don't know, I feel like this isn't something I don't want to get into too much right now, and I certainly don't want people to hate me for this, but I'm getting a little burned out with the Clone Wars anyway. I think we've beaten this enough as it is. Why doesn't Lucasfilm turn to, you know, the in between of episode 3 and episode 4? Why are we still beating on the Clone Wars? You know, they keep screwing up the canon as opposed to adding to it. So I'm just getting frustrated with that. Why did you need to bring Darth Maul back? You should be looking into wrapping up the series as opposed to prolonging it. I want to see something new, but you know, that's a separate issue. I mean, there were some great things about those episodes, you know, seeing Obi-Wan fighting with a red lightsaber, seeing Obi-Wan fighting alongside a Sith apprentice was very interesting, but I honestly thought that Asajj and Obi-Wan should have ended Savage and Darth Maul at the end of that episode easily, and they don't. So that really bothered me. But that's enough of that. That's all I really had to say about those. I mean, I enjoyed them. I found them entertaining. But, you know, the thing with Star Wars, when I think of Star Wars, especially the films, is the films are something I will go back and watch repeatedly. But these recent Clone Wars episodes, I watch one and I'm done. I'm ready for the next one, and I have no need to rewatch them. Which I know I'm probably in the minority of a lot of our listeners. I know a lot of the listeners love the Clone Wars. But this past season, I've watched each episode, and I'm just like, okay, that was enjoyable, but I don't need to rewatch it. And I feel like this season finale was the same thing. It was like, okay, I watched it, I'm up to speed, but I have no reason to rewatch this. And that's what bothers me, is because I love Star Wars, and Star Wars is all about staying power, and these recent Clone Wars episodes just don't have staying power, in my opinion. So, but that's my opinion.
Yeah. There are a few episodes out there that I, you know, won, and I'm okay with that. That's, you know, I don't really need to go back and rewatch it. But I am a fan of the Clone Wars. The Clone Wars time frame is one of my favorite eras in Star Wars. So I do like the series a lot, and I do rewatch a lot of the episodes, but
yeah, I mean,
that's just my bent. So
sure. I mean, the first two seasons blew me away. I was like, wow, these are amazing. But the last couple seasons, I've been like, okay, I'm ready to move on to something different, Star Wars. So, but that's me, and I know I'm in the minority, and I hope people don't hate me for that. It's just that's just my opinion. It's certainly not. You know, it certainly doesn't mean I'm going to stop watching the Clone Wars. I'm interested to see what they'll do with Darth Maul as well. But, you know, I was just a bit underwhelmed with that season finale. So
yeah.
But anyway, why don't we get into the rest of Obi-Wan? Unless there was anything else you wanted to say, Jason.
I just did want to mention my favorite moment of the two episodes there for the finale is when Asajj sneaks aboard the ship that Maul and Savage have captured Obi-Wan on. They've got Obi-Wan knocked out, and she walks in there like nothing's wrong, disappears, and they go to hunt for her, and she sneaks up and starts and slaps Obi-Wan across the face to wake him up. That was just my favorite moment in the entire finale, two-part finale. You know, so I love us. The thing the Clone Wars has done really well, in my opinion, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because we do have an episode to finish here. But the thing that they've done really well, in my opinion, is develop Asajj as a character. I know there's a lot of other stuff from the comics and the novels that she's done, but I think that what they've done in the Clone Wars has made her a much more interesting character than those other mediums did. So I'm really curious to see what they do with Asajj, and I'm really starting to root for her as a character in the series. So, but that's...
Yeah, no, I will... About that. Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. That's the one thing they've done excellently at the end of season 4 was develop Asajj. I mean, I thought she was a great bad guy to begin with, and now I like it how they've, you know, because Star Wars, especially the original trilogy, is a very black and white story. These are the good guys, these are the bad guys. And the prequel trilogy definitely gives us a little bit more of a shade of gray. And Asajj is definitely going through this shade of gray of, like, who is she? What is she going to become? And I do really appreciate that character development. To me, that is probably the best character right now in the Clone Wars. She has the most depth to her of all the other characters, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Yes, but on to Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Obi-Wan.
That's a name I've not heard in a long time. Actually, I just heard it because I just said it.
You are amazing. That was perfect, too. But of course I know him. He's me. And these droids do belong to you. So anyway, yeah, so the last episode we kind of finished off talking about Obi-Wan up through the Clone Wars. If there's anything else you wanted to say about the Clone Wars, Jason, or else we can jump into episode 3.
Let's take on Revenge of the Sith.
Revenge of the Sith it is then. So to me, the first thing that really stands out, and I'll kind of wrap this sequence up in a few words, and obviously Jason, if you want to comment as well. And I think the opening battle from, you know, the space battle all the way up through the duel with Dooku, I think more than anything what we see in that scene is the development of, you know, the relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan. Of course, we still have a few more seasons left in the Clone Wars that, again, I think that continually develops this deep companionship and this deep love between Anakin and Obi-Wan. But in that opening battle, we see how, you know, they're really two pieces of one puzzle, Anakin and Obi-Wan. They seem to complete each other in the field of combat. I mean, Obi-Wan, you know, his ship kind of gets knocked out, and he tells Anakin just to finish the mission, not to worry about him. But, you know, I think deep down inside, Obi-Wan wants Anakin to help him out. And, you know, when they fight Dooku there on, you know, on Grievous's flagship, Obi-Wan and Anakin fight like, you know, they are brothers. They fight together as one warrior. And, you know, it's a huge contrast between the last time we saw them fight together against Dooku in episode 2. You know, in episode 2, Obi-Wan's forced to fight on his own because his apprentice is too egotistical. And now we see, you know, they aren't just master and apprentice. They are two friends. They are two, you know, Jedi Knights who fight together for the same cause. And, you know, and after Obi-Wan gets knocked out of the fight and Anakin dispatches Dooku, and, you know, Palpatine is trying to hurry him along, and he says, you know, about Obi-Wan, no, his fate will be the same as ours. It just shows, you know, the camaraderie of these two characters. So right at the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, whether you're a Clone Wars fan or not, even if you've just watched Episode 2 and then Episode 3, we see that there has been this huge bond created between these two characters. They're not simply a master and apprentice anymore. They're best friends that would give their lives for each other. And I think that's fundamental in developing, you know, kind of the tragedy of both Anakin and Obi-Wan by the end of Revenge of the Sith. Is at the beginning of this film, they're best friends, which I think is awesome. They've done a great job developing that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And then, of course, that continues on to when they land and, you know, Obi-Wan says, "Oh, yes, you've earned your glorious day with the politicians." You know, and he's teasing Anakin about having to spend the rest of the day with all the senators while he has to go make his report to the council. You know, they're all friends, and, you know. "All right, but you owe me, and not for saving your life for the 10th time, 9th time. That business on Cato Pneumonia doesn't count." You know, so...
Gosh, if James Arnold Taylor ever needs a stand-in, Jason, call him up.
Oh, yes, I have James Arnold Taylor's number in my back pocket.
I wish you do.
I wish I did. I would be picking his brain all day long. but it is, they have become the best of friends and are inseparable in that. But the events that start happening start really rocking the boat for them in their relationship. And I guess my next point would be when Anakin is put on the council, and then Obi-Wan is given the responsibility of informing Anakin that the reason he's on the council is so that he can inform the council on what Palpatine is up to. And Anakin, you know, goes off on him about that. Which is obviously something Obi-Wan doesn't want to do to Anakin, you know. He says, you know, "I'm on your side. I didn't want to do this to you." You know, at the end of it, Anakin's like, "Why are you asking this of me?" And Obi-Wan's just forced to say, "Well, the council is asking." So, and that's, you know, these best friends, you know, still have, you know, tips and stuff, obviously. But this is just something that is a difficult moment for Obi-Wan, and he really doesn't want to put Anakin in a bad position, because he does care for Anakin so much.
Oh, yeah.
But he's forced to. He's still a junior member on the council. I mean, there's plenty of the council that's been on there longer than he has, so
yeah,
he's still gotta, you know, "Yes, master," you know. So
yeah.
But yeah.
And I think that's it. I think that's a continuing theme with Obi-Wan, though, that we talked about in the last show, is, you know, episodes 1 and 2, we see Obi-Wan as someone who is very obedient to the council. And, you know, now we start to see how this is going to be really a difficult situation for him. You know, he's placed in basically two different camps. You know, he has this loyalty to Anakin, but he also has this loyalty to the council. And, you know, the council is smart enough to know if Anakin's going to do this task, the only way he would agree to is through the advice of Obi-Wan. And poor Obi-Wan is stuck in this difficult position of, you know, he has loyalty to both camps. He's loyal to Anakin and the council, and he knows the turmoil this is going to cause for Anakin. Yeah. And he's very reluctant to do it. And I love the way the scene's done. He goes, "Why are you asking me to do this?" And Obi-Wan quickly deflects that. He doesn't take the personal responsibility of it. And he just says, "Well, the council's requesting it." You know, it's very clear that this isn't necessarily Obi-Wan's wish. It's the council's wish, which Obi-Wan is giving into.
Yeah, he's stuck between a rock and a hothead.
Absolutely.
So it is a very uncomfortable situation, and one that he probably has, you know, the council probably intended to use more than once, unfortunately, because the easiest way to influence Anakin is to have Obi-Wan do it, because Anakin respects him so much. So
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, at this point in the film, Obi-Wan is still... To me, it's difficult to pinpoint his relationship with Anakin. You know, is he still kind of his master? Is he his friend? Is he his brother? Is he his father figure? And I think at certain points still, Obi-Wan tries to act like a little bit of a father figure for Anakin. You know, and he points out in that scene as well, you know, your friendship with Palpatine seems to be paying off. You know, he keeps implicating that what Palpatine is pushing for Anakin is kind of what Anakin wants all along. And Obi-Wan is, you know, he's cautioning, be careful of your friendship here. And Obi-Wan isn't saying this for political means. He's not saying it on behalf of the council. Obi-Wan's cautions to Anakin about Palpatine come because Obi-Wan is his dear friend. And he's nervous for Anakin, you know. I think you're being manipulated here, Anakin. Be careful. And I think he really has Anakin's best interest at heart. But of course, Anakin's not capable of seeing that. And that's what's so sad about Obi-Wan, is Obi-Wan really does want what's best for Anakin, but Anakin's not capable of seeing that.
Right. Right. Moving on, I don't have hardly anything to say about Obi-Wan's encounter with Grievous. If you wanted to mention anything about that or anything before that, go ahead. But I don't have anything until after then.
Yeah, I just... just one more point then before any of probably what you want to say. I think the scene before Obi-Wan leaves for Utapau, you know, once they find out, you know, Obi-Wan's the one who's going to go after Grievous, there's that endearing little scene where Anakin and Obi-Wan part ways. And if you think about it, this is the last time they're together as friends. Because the next time they encounter each other, they, you know, are out to kill each other. And it's a little bit of a reconciliation scene where, to me, it sort of mirrors the scene between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon in Episode 1 at the end, where, you know, Obi-Wan is reconciling his relationship with Qui-Gon after he's been a bit annoyed with, you know, his selection of Jar Jar than Anakin. Here it is, you know, Obi-Wan is making it very clear to Anakin, you know, you're a great Jedi. Be patient. It's okay. And, you know, when Anakin says goodbye, Obi-Wan says, goodbye, old friend. You know, it's very clear. You know, you're my friend. I care about you. You know, I really like that scene because it says a lot about who he is. And there's one little scene from the novel, actually, that's obviously not in the film, that I think is worth mentioning. It's the scene when Obi-Wan is on the transport with Mace Windu and Yoda, and Yoda's about to leave for Kashyyyk, and they're having this conversation about Anakin, and, you know, Obi-Wan's explaining to Mace and Yoda how Anakin did not take very kindly to his new assignment of essentially spying on Palpatine. And Obi-Wan shows his depth of understanding of people. He makes it very clear. This is going to be very difficult for Anakin because Anakin isn't like us in the rest of the council. Anakin's not loyal to ideals. Anakin's not loyal to, you know, a code of conduct, a republic. He's loyal to people. And what we've asked him to do is betray a friend. And Obi-Wan makes it very clear. I'm sad about this. I'm worried he'll never trust me again. And it shows just how aware Obi-Wan is of Anakin's feelings. And I think that's great because it shows Obi-Wan is a lot like Qui-Gon at this point in the Star Wars films. He's very in tune with the Living Force. He's very in tune with what's going on inside of Anakin. But he doesn't know how to speak that up and be in contradiction with the Council. And I think it shows Obi-Wan has such a depth of compassion in a way that the rest of the Council does not have. And I always really liked that scene.
Yeah, no, that's a very good scene in the novel. I'd forgotten about that. It would have been nice to see if they had expanded the scene from the movie to include some of that dialogue. But as far as the scene between Anakin and Obi-Wan before he leaves for Utapau, it is a nice little scene. You know, the last time they speak as friends, basically. And while they reconcile and stuff, the scene just has this sense of finality, which is, you know, obviously as, you know, viewers, we know what's going to happen. but it even to the characters, it almost looks like there's, for some reason, there's some sort of finality to this, and it's they don't want it to be that way, but they're not sure what the future is going to bring. So it's just a really interesting scene, the way it all ends, you know. So they, you know, I don't know if I'm making sense there.
No. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of these in-between scenes before we get to the battle on Utapau and the duel with Grievous and whatnot is really what's happening with Obi-Wan is we're being shown just how in tune he is with Anakin. And again, to me, it just reiterates how in love he is with Anakin. And it gives me so much more respect for him because I think more than anything, Obi-Wan is becoming more a person and less a Jedi, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Because I think one of the biggest flaws of the Jedi Council at this point, you know, in the Star Wars movies, this, you know, by Episode 3, the Council is just so, it's so focused on its code of conduct. It's so focused on, you know, doing what is right and what is right. Whereas Obi-Wan is, he's doing his best to do what's right for people. And I think Obi-Wan is one of the greatest Jedi at this point because of that. And I think Anakin's had such a profound impact on who he is as a person. So,
yeah. The Council as a whole is very detached, whereas Obi-Wan is trying to make these personal connections.
Right.
So,
and I think he shows the importance of personal connection as opposed to, you know, I think he properly understands the idea of detachment. You know, the Council seems to interpret detachment as have no real feelings for anybody because it'll just result in something bad. Whereas Obi-Wan is saying, no, it's human to have feelings, and I do have feelings. And I don't know, I love who he's become as a character.
Yeah, he is definitely one of the most interesting characters of the prequels. So, in the whole saga, I mean, he's just a very interesting character in general. So, did you have anything before Order 66?
Were you going to say anything about the duel itself or no?
Between him and Grievous, not really. I mean, Grievous isn't really that scary.
No.
He really isn't. Obi-Wan just demonstrates yet again that he is the man, and you know, even if he has to use such an uncivilized weapon like a blaster. So, that's basically all I have to say about the duel.
Yeah, all I was going to say, and again, this is, I love drawing from the novel because I love the novel, and I know you do as well, Jason. But I think it's really cool. There's a scene in the novel that's not in the film where, you know, Obi-Wan is talking with Mace Windu about, you know, why'd you select me to go fight Grievous? And Mace Windu says, because you're the master of Form 2. You know, it's really cool how it's very clear now that Obi-Wan, you know, he's not just some average Jedi on the Council. Like, not only is he so in tune with the Living Force, but he's also, like, he is a deadly warrior. They picked him to fight Grievous because they knew he would win. And when Obi-Wan enters the fight, you know, he plops down in between all these droids and these battle droids and Grievous, and he's like, hello there. he's not afraid at all. I mean, Obi-Wan is somebody who's so in control of his emotions, and he's just not afraid. He's confident in who he is. And I think that's very profound about who he is. But that's all I was going to say in regards to that scene.
Okay.
So please go on.
All right. Well, of course, we get to Order 66, which comes as a shock to all the Jedi. And Obi-Wan is forced to go underground and forced to run from Cody and his troops. And he can't even make contact with the chairman of Utapau anymore because they're being taken into custody, and so everything is all of a sudden in one fell swoop turned on its head, and Obi-Wan has to steal Grievous's starfighter to get off planet, and find out what is going on. And he meets up, obviously, with Bail Organa and Yoda to try and figure out why this happened. And, you know, Obi-Wan barely manages to survive. He didn't even sense that it was going to happen, that he was being fired upon. You know, the only reason he survived is because I missed. And he fell in water. So, you know, obviously from, you know, hundreds of feet in the air. But it's... And now he's gone back into this detective mode that we saw him in during episode two. He's now going back and trying to figure out what's going on. Why did we get... Why did our clones turn on this, turn on us? And he is the type of person that he has to go and fix things, make sure that things are all right for others. And so he has to go and make this right. And he and Yoda obviously find out that, you know, 98%, 99% of the Jedi have been wiped out by this. And they go back to the temple. And, you know, after finding Padawans and other Jedi killed by a lightsaber, you know, Obi-Wan asked Yoda who could have done this. And Yoda probably already at this point knows, because once they go into the security recordings, you know, Yoda warns him, you know, if you go in there, only pain will you find, you know. If you did the security recordings, you go, only pain will you find. Obi-Wan is like, I have to know. And Anakin, obviously, his dear friend, this kid that he's, you know, guided and protected this for years now, has turned to the dark side and slaughtered Jedi, you know, the institution that Obi-Wan has been devoted to since his youth. And in one fell swoop, he has lost a best friend and the foundation for the identity that he has. Because now, basically, the Jedi are no more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's such a earth-shattering set of circumstances there for Obi-Wan.
Yeah. Yeah. To kind of just recap on the scenes you were just mentioning, you know, again, after the Order 66 is carried out on him and he, you know, he does go into that detective mode like you mentioned from episode two, he also reveals again his attachment to the Order. You know, well, we have to go back. They, you know, they find out about the beacon calling all the Jedi back, so they'll be slaughtered. And Obi-Wan says to Yoda, you know, we need to go back. We need to fix this. We need to undo this. You know, it's his attempt to keep alive the very thing that gives him his identity. He's a Jedi. And the Order is in, you know, is in danger of being wiped out. So Obi-Wan's reaction is, I need to do everything I can to save the thing I love. You know, it's to me, it's kind of funny. He's acting very similar to his own apprentice. Remember, I mean, Anakin, everything he's doing in episode three is to try and save the one he loves, Padme. In a similar sense, when Obi-Wan goes back to Coruscant, he's doing something very similar. Now, granted, he does not go through the horrible means that Anakin does, but he's doing something similar. He has an attachment to the Order. He wants to try to keep it alive. And again, that attachment is something good. I mean, this is his family. These are the people that have defined his whole life. And his reaction is, we need to do something to stop this. We need to do our best to keep this Order alive. So, you know, he goes back. And, of course, when he goes back, they do uncover these tapes showing that Anakin / Darth Vader is the one who has, you know, enacted all of these horrible deeds on the Order. And in the movie, it doesn't do a very good job of capturing Obi-Wan's emotion. You know, he's just like, oh, I can't watch anymore. But if you read that scene in the book, it does such an excellent job. I mean, I wish I had the novel in front of me right now. I'd read the excerpt. I don't have it, though. And it, you know, basically says, you know, Obi-Wan's knees buckle. I mean, he falls to the floor in agony. I mean, his whole body is gripped in pain. You know, this is his best friend killing the one thing he loves. You know, it just doesn't make sense to him. I mean, you know, imagine your best friend walking into the room and shooting the girl you love in the face. You know, I mean, this is essentially what Anakin has done. I mean, he's killed Obi-Wan's most deep love, and Obi-Wan is just floored by this. I mean, you know, I mean, the amount of pain he must feel is, you know, unimaginable. And I love his immediate reaction, you know, because Yoda is, again, is this cold, detached character. All right, this is what it is. This is what we have to do. You know, it's almost like no feeling. And Obi-Wan steps right up. Let me go kill the Emperor. You know, he doesn't want to kill Anakin. But of course, Yoda makes it very clear. Well, you don't stand a chance against the Emperor. So let me handle that. You're going to have to go take care of Anakin. And we see just how much pain this causes Obi-Wan. You know, Obi-Wan's whole life is falling down around him in this scene. The order that has been his whole family, that has been his social network, is in the process of complete annihilation. His closest friend is the one who has done this. I mean, just think about it. How can Obi-Wan think clearly right now? Yet he's still capable of doing it. When he goes off to Padme to basically play Padme to get Anakin's location out of her. Which is the next scene I'll mention. But is there anything else you wanted to get into there, Jason?
That was where I was going next.
Yeah, so. Please go ahead. No, go ahead.
Yeah, well, he gets to Padme, and obviously that's a very shrewd move on his part, because obviously he knows that Anakin and Padme are good friends. You know, they've been friends from, you know, episode one, and then that was reunited, you know, reunited in episode two. And this is where we bring into the question, how much does Obi-Wan really know? You know, does he know that they're married? Does he know that they're, you know, lovers? You know, how much does he really know? And I'm of the camp that I think Obi-Wan probably did know, but he's very good when it comes to Anakin to turning a blind eye to those types of faults. You know, there are some faults where he will be all over, like his relationship with Palpatine, but Padme's relationship is something different, and I think Obi-Wan thinks that it's, you know, good for him just to a degree. And so he just sort of lets whatever happen, and he, you know, doesn't, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil type of thing. But when he's confronted with what Anakin has done, all of those veils are ripped off, and I'm pretty sure he may not realize that they actually got married, but he probably figured that they were, in every sense of the word, in that sort of relationship by that point. And then, of course, he discovers when he's talking with Padme that, you know, she's pregnant. And of course, he says, you know, Anakin's the father, isn't he? She can't respond, and his final word to her there was, I'm so sorry. Because he has to kill Anakin, because he's become a very great threat, you know.
Yeah.
As he puts it, so it's, you know. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the scene we see, and I'm with you, Jason, I'm in the camp that Obi-Wan is very well aware. I mean, again, we've seen all throughout episode 3 how in tune he is with who Anakin is, how in tune he is with Anakin's emotions. Obi-Wan's no idiot. I think it's very clear to him that something is going on with Anakin and Padme. Now, granted, maybe he doesn't know they're married or, you know, all the particular details of it, but I think he knows something is going on. And like you just said, Jason, I think he's okay with it to a certain degree, because he knows it's kind of what Anakin needs, so he's not all over him about it like he is with his relationship with Palpatine. But I think in this particular scene, when he's confronting Padme, you know, he makes it very clear to her, look at Anakin he's become deluded. He is no longer Anakin. He's lost himself. And unfortunately, I need to destroy the evil he has become. And of course, Padme's not going to give him up. And, you know, like you said, I mean, Obi-Wan's last lines to her is, I'm so sorry. And he is. He is sorry, not only because he has to go kill Anakin, but he's sorry, I think, just in a broader sense of how everything turned out. You know, Anakin was somebody who was so needed, had so much need of love. Padme gave that to him, but he had to keep it secret. And I think to some extent, and I could be wrong, of course, but I think to some extent, Obi-Wan is apologizing on behalf of the Jedi. I'm so sorry that you had to keep the secret. I'm so sorry that everything that's happening right now is probably the result of the fact that Anakin had to keep this a secret. I think it's more an apology to Padme than it is an apology for having to kill Anakin. I think he is truly sorry of what's happened to his good friends, because I think he sincerely cares about Padme as well. And to know that, you know, their love had to be kept secret, their love had to be hidden behind all these veils, I think that makes Obi-Wan sad. And again, I think that says something about who he is as a character. It shows, a certain sense of realism to Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan realizes that there can be life for a Jedi outside of the confines of the Council, perhaps. However, he is still sold on the fact that he needs to go destroy Anakin for the sake of the Council. You know, I mean, he is still convinced, though. Although he is sad, he is distraught by all this, he's going to go do his duty and eradicate a Sith. And of course, you know, he shows his unique spy abilities, because he hides out under Padme's skiff there and hops on board and all that.
Hides in a utility closet.
Yes, of course. And then strokes his goatee ever so eloquently. I like to stroke my scuffle at work sometimes, and I'm like, I'm certainly no Obi-Wan. But, it shows that he's sly, though, too. You know, he knows how to get things done. Even he's able to take all that emotion, the fact that he's feeling so much, and still place it aside, knowing that he has a duty. And I think to some extent we can respect Obi-Wan's character for that as well. You know, he has all this emotion, just like his apprentice, but he knows how to control that emotion. He knows how to focus that emotion, which shows why he's the far more mature character. That's all I have to say until the duel, really. Unless you have anything else to say, Jason.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. Of course, we get to Mustafar. Anakin greets and then chokes his wife. When Obi-Wan shows up and Anakin starts railing against Obi-Wan for turning her against him, and starts talking about how he's so powerful and my new empire, and Obi-Wan is just can't believe the words that are coming out of Anakin's mouth. This isn't Anakin, this is some monster. I can't imagine what that confrontation felt like. I can't even put into words how mind-blowing that would have been from Obi-Wan's perspective. Because obviously Anakin is at this point where, he's starting to really delve into the darkness that, he's embraced here. And so he's starting to believe all these things he's saying. But Obi-Wan is just dumbfounded almost by what Anakin has become and what he's having and what he's saying and what he's doing. And at the end, I will do what I must. You will try. And the duel ensues.
Yeah. And I'm with you. That the scene, the dialogue between the two of them before the duel, it's like Obi-Wan's looking at the face of a person he knows so well, so intimately, yet the words coming out of his mouth are the words that he's used to hearing from his enemy. I mean, imagine that turmoil he must be feeling inside. Like, how are these words coming out of my best friend? It makes no sense to him. And in the end, he concedes to the fact that I have to do what I must. To Obi-Wan, I think, his duty to the Force, his duty to eradicating evil from the galaxy, trumps his devotion to his friend, because I think this is the scene where Obi-Wan allows himself to accept the fact that this isn't his friend anymore. His friend has been killed by this Darth Vader. You know, and that's, again, how it'll be funny, too, then when we see him again in the original trilogy when he explains to Luke what happens to his father. I think this is the truth that Obi-Wan's going to come to convince himself that, indeed, his friend Anakin Skywalker was killed by Darth Vader. And
it's his coping mechanism.
Exactly.
That's how he rationalizes things. That's how he was able to come to the conclusion that this has happened.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Obi-Wan in this scene, you know, if he's about to draw Blaze with his best friend, he needs to have a darn good reason as to why he's going to do that. And his reason now is fine. I'm about to fight Darth Vader. Anakin Skywalker's dead. If anything, he's about to fight the enemy of his best friend. He's going to vanquish the person who killed his best friend. You know, it might be the face of his best friend, but, you know, the person on the inside is dead. And I think this is, like you said, it's Obi-Wan's coping mechanism, which we'll see carried through into the original trilogy. And I'll save a few of those comments for a little bit later. But, you know, then I'm going to wrap up pretty much Revenge of the Sith for myself here with just a few points. And then I'll let you do the same, Jason, if I missed anything. But, you know, after the duel, we see this heartbreaking scene between Anakin and Obi-Wan, where Anakin's laying there, you know, with basically one arm left. And Obi-Wan says to him, you know, you are the chosen one. I loved you. And, you know, we've never heard a Jedi say, I love you, to anyone. And I think Obi-Wan is the first Jedi to allow himself to be made vulnerable. He allows himself to fall in love. And I love that he allowed that, and it breaks my heart when he says that. You know, Obi-Wan, you know, just opened himself up to Anakin. He gave his whole self to Anakin. And what does Anakin do? He spits it in the drain, you know. And poor Obi-Wan here is heartbroken. And, you know, I remember when I first saw that scene on the big screen, you know, jeepers, what, 8 years ago now, it brought tears to my eyes, you know, and more specifically for Obi-Wan, because this is somebody, you know, Obi-Wan has always been doing what is right. He's been trying so hard. He gave his whole love, all of his love to Anakin. Here he confesses it. Yet, it wasn't enough somehow. And there's a line in the book that's not in the film where he says, you know, I loved you, Anakin, but it could not save you. I could not save you. And I think that's so devastating for Obi-Wan, because all he wanted was for Anakin to be happy, and it just didn't happen. And I think that scene is absolutely devastating.
Yeah, it is. It is one of the most heart-wrenching scenes from the entire saga. Just the loss of a hero, and the emotional impact that has on Obi-Wan. It is. It's just devastating. It's, you know, galaxy-shaking, you could say. And then, of course, he has to go rescue Padme, who's going into labor because of this, and she has twins. And now he has another reason to go on, is to protect the son of Anakin Skywalker and make sure he doesn't turn out the way that his father did.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do like that scene as well. You know, I mean, he agrees, you know, in the little conference scene there with Bail and Tilly's and Yoda and Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan agrees to look after Luke. And again, it's kind of his last homage to his best friend. You know, I couldn't keep you safe, but I will look after your son. And again, it shows his continued devotion to his friend. Which I really like. So, you know, and then the last scene we see of Obi-Wan in the prequel trilogy is him handing Luke off. And I like it because it shows Obi-Wan's surrender to the will of the Force in a new way. You know, he doesn't... you know, and again, in the book, it's a lot more fleshed out than the film gives us. And Obi-Wan is basically saying to Yoda, like, okay, who's going to train who? How are we going to go about training these, you know, sons of Anakin and sons and daughter of Anakin so that they can, you know, overthrow the Emperor and whatnot? And Yoda says, well, no. We're going to try something different here. And I like the scene in the film because it's Obi-Wan's, surrender and consent to the fact that the Force will take care of the future now. The Force has given them these two twins, and it'll be up to the Force to see how their future will be. And Obi-Wan allows himself to fade into the back, the backlight a bit, and let what happens to Luke happen. And it shows his consent to letting the Force take control now. You know, it's like we as the Jedi did all that we could, and we couldn't prevent the dark side from rising up. So let's let the living Force take control. And I think that scene where he gives Luke up shows that.
Yeah. The Jedi couldn't control the way events happened. So let's let the Force have a chance, almost. It's the Force is, what's supposed to be driving the Jedi. And so it's about time they let the Force run its course. You know, that was such a bad rhyme and unintentional. But it is. And I think that's one of the things that Obi-Wan has come to realize is that as much as the Jedi want to do good for the galaxy, want to make sure that peace and justice is kept, they have come to the place where it's up to them what is peace and justice. And that's not the way it should be. The Force is what drives them and controls them. And so he's now surrendering to that and letting the Force dictate how he goes about the rest of his exile now on Tatooine, which shows just the maturity of Obi-Wan. He's in his late 30s and he's still willing to learn and willing to be a vessel for the Force. So,
absolutely. So, do you want to hop into the original trilogy then, Jason?
Let's hop.
Okay. Yeah. And again, this is the time frame I'm really curious to see more of, is this time frame between episodes 3 and 4, which is why, again, to go back to what I was saying earlier in the episode, and again, I apologize for people that think I hate the Clone Wars. I don't hate it, but I would love to see more being done with this time frame between episodes 3 and 4. I'd love to see more about, Darth Vader and his rise to power, and what is Obi-Wan up to? In that novel by James Luceno, or Lucino, however you say it, his novel on Darth Vader, the very epilogue of that novel, and spoiler alert to any of you who have not read it, so, earmuff it right now. But, we have this initial scene where Obi-Wan contacts Qui-Gon, and obviously Obi-Wan's going to be trained into how to connect with the Force after death. I'd love to see how Obi-Wan's character's developed through that. But we don't have anything on that right now. So, to jump into the original trilogy, when we first see Obi-Wan, he kind of is this crazy old hermit. And to me, his character's developed into being somebody very similar to his master, Qui-Gon. He's got wild hair, he's a bit wild looking, he's kind of this old wizard. As
a little disheveled.
Yeah, a little disheveled, and there's like a sense of humor to him. But what we learn ultimately is once he starts to encounter Luke, is I think he is that character of wisdom who's going to call Luke out and say, all right, I think it's time now for you to step out and start to make a change in your life and start to do something for the galaxy. And we start to see, again, Obi-Wan's continued devotion to the will of the Force. I think Obi-Wan is so in tune with the Force at this point that he is kind of the character who's capable of telling Luke, all right, there's something more. It's kind of apparent in Episode 4 that there might have been a few interactions between Obi-Wan and Luke in the past. Yet Obi-Wan probably never implied who he was, never implied that he is, meant for greatness. All of a sudden, though, things are starting to develop where Obi-Wan, again, he's to me, he's kind of a Force meteorologist. He's able to see the changing weather of the Force, and, he's able to say, okay, Luke, I think it's time now. And if I may just very, very, very briefly give this a bit of a biblical connotation. In the Gospel of John, we see Mary, the mother of Jesus, at the wedding of Cana, say to Jesus, "Okay, Jesus, I think it's time for you to step out, start doing the mission that God gave you." I think Obi-Wan is a lot like Mary in this scene. You know, he's so in tune with the will of the Force, just like she's so in tune with the will of God, that he's able to say, "Hey, Luke, open your eyes a bit. There's something more going on here. I can offer you so much more. I think it's time for you to step out." And of course, he doesn't force Luke into anything. He doesn't demand it of him, but he's the one who's going to, you know, open Luke's eyes to even the reality of what the Force is. You know, what's the Force? And then Obi-Wan gets into this long spiel about what it is. He tells him a little bit about his father. You know, Obi-Wan is, you know, in all those long years of meditation, he's become so in tune with the Force that he's able to accurately predict, all right, maybe this is the will of the Force now. It's time for Luke to step out. And that's what he's going to do basically the rest of Episode 4, is invite Luke into this journey into the Force.
Yeah. Yeah. Before I jump into Obi-Wan's, you know, teaching of Luke there back in his hovel, I just want to get one little thing in. It's really interesting how when Obi-Wan rescues Luke, and Luke, you know, asks about Obi-Wan Kenobi, and, you know, we have that Obi-Wan Kenobi line that I, you know, quoted earlier. It's really interesting because now that it's time for Luke's journey to start, Obi-Wan reclaims his name. Because he's been going by Ben this whole time, Ben Kenobi. He reclaims that name of Obi-Wan, that Jedi, that identity there. He's been going by this crazy wizard, Ben, for, you know, almost two decades now. But now that it's time for Luke's destiny to start launching, he regains that identity of Obi-Wan, that Jedi master, not just some crazy old hermit living in the desert. So
yeah, I like that. And, you know, in the same way he's going to shake Luke up, I think Luke shakes him up a bit. You know, oh, he says he belongs to somebody named Obi-Wan, and, you know, again, to go back to that great quote you gave earlier, Jason, Obi-Wan does, you know, he steps forward and says, yeah, that's who I am. And you know, it's time for me to become that person again, to be that person that I am, instead of just this old hermit. So that's a great point. Good job, Jason. Yeah.
Thank you. But of course, we get to that scene in Obi-Wan's hovel there, and, you know, that's just full of great stuff. Obviously, some of the most interesting stuff for me is, you know, pushing Luke towards his destiny, towards, you know, leaving Tatooine, but also it's the stuff on his father, Anakin. And he, you know, obviously, for, you know, good reason, apparently, that doesn't give Luke the whole picture. You know, and we see that hesitation there in the film. You know, Alec Guinness does a great job as giving this little nod of, well, let's see, how much am I going to tell him this time? You know, how much does he need to know? And it's just, you know, he gives it a nice big chunk there, but he's got the whole rest of the loaf still back here that he's going to save for later. Of course, Vader beats him to that revelation, obviously, but I just find it very interesting that he takes his time revealing everything. And obviously, you know, oh yeah, your father was a Jedi. Now he's a Sith. He's terrorizing the galaxy as Darth Vader. You want to come join the rebels with me? You know, that wouldn't have worked. So
Yeah.
So obviously he's doing this, doling this out one nugget at a time based on where Luke is able to, you know, contain it. But that just shows his wisdom and how in tune he is with the Force, you know, as to know when to reveal these things. So
yeah, absolutely, I agree. You know, it shows when Anakin, or excuse me, Anakin, Luke asks, you know, what happened to my father? There's that scene where you can, if you watch the emotion on Obi-Wan's face, it's almost like he's quickly figuring out, how do I put this? How do I phrase this right now? You know, there's this a little bit of a perplexed look, and then he gives him that certain point of view.
He sort of just nods to himself slightly, and then he launches into his little story.
Yeah. So. And like you said earlier, you know, I think this is a certain truth for Obi-Wan anyway. This is the truth he convinced himself of, you know, 20 years ago when he had to fight Anakin on Mustafar. You know, well, your father was killed by somebody named Darth Vader. And, you know, that's true to some extent. And that's enough truth for Luke right now. He's wise enough to know he doesn't have to unpack everything for Luke quite yet, because he's not ready for that yet. You know,
no.
He's again assuming a little bit of a parent role or a grandparent role in this particular case, kind of like what he'd done with Anakin. You know, he knows what it means to be a good parent. You know, when your kid asks you, is Santa Claus real, when he's, you know, 5 years old, you know, you say something. When he's 7 years old, you say something a little bit different. When he's 13 years old, you say something a little bit different still, you know? You can only give them as much as they're ready to handle. And Obi-Wan knows, you know, all right, I'm going to give Luke just enough to give him the truth, but not overwhelm him. And I think that's a great scene. If you don't mind me jumping forward, the next real big scene, we see Obi-Wan obviously training Luke on the Falcon. And was there anything you wanted to mention before that, Jason?
No.
Okay.
That's you know, the rest of it is, you know, introducing other characters and more exposition as to how they get out there. But no, that is the next moment. And I won't dwell too long on this because there's more stuff later that I want to touch on. But, you know, he's starting to unveil, you know, the way that the Jedi go about things, how they reach out with their feelings, you know, trust the Force, and how they communicate with the Force. He's, you know, he's not going to give the little, you know, well, the midichlorians, you know, that spiel that Qui-Gon gave, because that's not what Luke needs. Luke is trusting. Luke, you know, understands, you know, it just is ready to just dive into it, whereas Anakin needed answers. So he's just going to start teaching him this stuff, and, you know, then of course he feels Alderaan, you know, go boom, and you know, that's unsettles him a bit, which is something we hadn't seen in the film up to that point. You know, he's Obi-Wan at this point. Obi-Wan's always, you know, in control of, you know, his emotions and his situations, and, you know, but then all of a sudden he's very unsettled and has to, you know, figure out what's going on. But that's, you know, obviously he has his answer very shortly soon after. So I'll let you go ahead and talk about this.
I don't have much to say there either, except, you know, I mean, again, it shows Obi-Wan's ability to train somebody. He's very honest with Luke. You know, the Force is something that you have to trust. It's something that you have to give yourself to. You have to trust your feelings. And I really like that. He's very confident in his training of Luke. You know, where it seems like maybe he'd be a bit jaded after the failure of his last apprentice, he seems to be very confident in what he's doing with Luke. And I like that. I think Obi-Wan has become very self-assured in those, you know, those long years between Anakin and Luke. And he's confident that he can train Luke, and that, you know, Luke is a different person than his father, and Luke can handle it differently. So I think that's a really good scene. I have nothing else to say from episode 4 except for his you know, scenes with Darth Vader.
That's basically it. I mean,
yeah.
He now he has the opportunity to finally finish what he started on Mustafar. And, you know, he's running around the Death Star and avoiding him and working around Vader. And Vader, obviously, you know, he senses Obi-Wan and identifies who he is. And he's, you know, out to hunt him down and finally end this once and for all, you know. And finally, you know, Obi-Wan's, you know, like, well, I'm not going to go and make myself a target, but if it's the will of the Force, I'll confront him. And he does. And they have the duel, and Obi-Wan, in a way, does win. He finally bests his apprentice by saving Luke, sacrificing himself so Luke can get away, and becomes one with the Force in front of Vader's eyes, which obviously shocks Vader, because he's like, wait, what? He's gone? How does that happen? How does one just disappear out of their cloak when you slash them with a lightsaber? Because, you know, usually they just fall over, you know, lay there, dead.
They don't disappear.
But, you know, Obi-Wan has obviously learned and grown so much in the Force in his, you know, while he's been on Tatooine. And so now, even though he's quote-unquote dead, he's one with the Force, and he's able to overcome and surmount the power that Anakin was so craving last time they met. And has the final comeuppance against Vader.
Yeah. And what's so much different in this scene is, you know, this is a very interesting duel if you think about it, because it's two old men. You know, is what everybody says, but you know, I don't think Darth Vader necessarily beats Obi-Wan in the scene. I think it's much more that Obi-Wan surrenders to the Force, and I think he realizes, you know, there's not much more I can do in this state of being. So I'm going to surrender to the Force, and, you know, if I sacrifice myself here, Luke and his friends will be able to get away, and I'm not cut off from him. To me, the most incredible thing about Obi-Wan here is he's not afraid of death. You know, and that's the biggest fear of the Sith, is they're so afraid of dying, they're so afraid of annihilation. You know, that's why they're working so hard to find eternal life. But Obi-Wan shows that he understands the secret to eternal life. Eternal life isn't gained through power, it's not gained through knowledge, it's not gained through, you know, how much of the Force do you understand. It's gained through surrender to the Force. And that's what we see happen in this scene, is Obi-Wan gives himself completely trusting to the Force, knowing that this won't be the end for him. And that's why he's able to conquer Vader in the end. Because he doesn't need his blade to do it. He gives himself over to the Force. And, you know, in this scene, he's, you know, in a sense, he's killed by Darth Vader, but he's not really killed. And he makes it very clear, you know, if you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you could possibly imagine. And that's exactly it, because power isn't about how strong are you with the Force, how strong are you in your combat skills, but power comes from surrender, and Obi-Wan does that there. And I think more than anything, he gives an example to Luke. Look, you have nothing to fear if you give yourself to the Force. And that's really what he does there. He's showing Luke what it really means to be a Jedi. A Jedi is somebody who is completely surrendered to the Force. And as I'm saying this now, I realize how this is a bit similar to... I was teaching my sophomores today in class about St. Paul's understanding of salvation. And I won't get into this too much because I know our listeners don't want to hear a theology lesson. But, you know, ultimately what Jesus does on the cross is he shows people what it means to be human. He shows us that we can, you know, be free to love without any cost. We don't have to be afraid of loving, even if it means costing our lives. And I think Obi-Wan does the same thing here. What it means to be a Jedi is to give yourself completely to the Force, even if that means death. Because even in death, you aren't annihilated. The Force will reclaim you. And that's what happens to Obi-Wan. So,
yeah.
So that's really it for me for A New Hope. And I only have a few things to say about his involvement in episodes 5 and 6. But what else did you want to bring up, Jason?
Nothing really until... I guess briefly maybe the end of... The Empire Strikes Back, when Luke is leaving Dagobah, and, you know, Obi-Wan shows up and, you know, tells Luke, you know, I can't help you with this. This isn't the right time. You know, I cannot interfere. You know, you're going to have to fight Vader alone. And obviously, that's not the way that Obi-Wan wanted this to go. It's not the way that he believes it should have gone. And, you know, now Luke has this revelation, and, you know, that's not the way Obi-Wan intended for Luke to find out that Vader was his father, and so he almost loses hope there, because, you know, as Luke is taking off, he says to Yoda, you know, that boy is our only hope. And, you know, Yoda has to correct him and say, no, there is another. You know, we have a backup plan. So, meaning Leia, of course. And, but Luke jumps the gun, and Obi-Wan is, like, putting up red flags and saying, stop, wait, hold up. And, you know, Luke just has to race by him. So, yeah. Thankfully, things turn out okay.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, because I think what happens in those scenes on Dagobah where Luke is about to rush off is Obi-Wan's afraid the same thing's going to happen to Luke as it did to Vader. And that's, he makes that very clear. I don't want to lose you to the Emperor the way I lost Vader. You know, he's nervous. This is deja vu a bit, you know. Is Luke going to rush off, you know, hot on his emotion? But, you know, and he's, it shows that he really has confidence that Luke is the answer to the darkness. Luke is capable of rising above it in a way that his father couldn't. But when he's about to rush off like this, like you said, you know, he says to Yoda, that boy is our last hope. He seems a bit defeated. And again, Yoda has to step in to keep Obi-Wan's focus in check. Really, I only have a couple things left to say about Obi-Wan. Do you want me to just wrap up, or did you, just a couple quick things from Return of the Jedi? Or did you have anything else from Empire you wanted to say?
No, the only thing I really have is the scene on Dagobah in Jedi and the scene at the end when they show up. That's it. So I'll just jump into Obi-Wan and Luke on Dagobah. It's interesting because, you know, Luke is now demanding answers. He's now he knows that Vader is his father, and he wants to know what's going on. Why is he in the dark? And so Obi-Wan has to finally, you know, take off the, you know, the coping mechanism there from between Anakin and Vader, and he has to start telling these things. And he's a bit jaded at Vader. You know, he's, you know, jaded and, you know, very, you know, lost any hope that Anakin can be reached again. That's why he's put so much time and energy into Luke. But he's, you know, he reveals and tells a story and, you know, talks about Luke's sister. But the most interesting thing from Obi-Wan's perspective that I find is that he is, you know, while he has faith in Luke's abilities, he is just so jaded and hopeless as far as Anakin's condition is, whereas Luke is like, I can save him. There's good in him. Obi-Wan can't see it because he was, you know, betrayed and lost so much because of that betrayal.
Absolutely, and I think that's a great way of putting it. Is, you know, in that particular scene on Dagobah in Return of the Jedi, Obi-Wan is kind of the one who really wraps up. He wraps together the prequels and the original trilogy. You know, he tells the full story to Luke here. But like you said, he is absolutely jaded. To him, you know, Anakin is more machine than man, twisted and evil. You know, there is no hope for Anakin Skywalker. He has been consumed by the evil that is Darth Vader. And in a very real way, I mean, that was his last experience of his friend. And again, the last time he really even met his friend, if you want to say that, was on the Death Star there in Episode 4, and, you know, he was trying to kill him. You know, in Obi-Wan's eyes, Anakin is past redemption. The only way Luke can, you know, save the galaxy is by destroying him and the Emperor. And it's funny because as in tune with the Force as Obi-Wan is, the one thing he's incapable of seeing is the goodness in Anakin. And again, I think it's because he's been so, you know, betrayed by him, you know. His best friend turned his back on him. And I don't think he can just let that go. He can't just walk away from that reality. So he's incapable of seeing the goodness in Anakin. But of course, Luke proves him wrong. And then at the end of the film, we see Obi-Wan and Anakin and Yoda all reunited in the Force. And I think at the end of the film there, we see, you know, Obi-Wan, you know, welcoming the redemption of his friend.
So. Yes, it was almost a miracle, you know. It's something he felt could never happen. You know, his skepticism, his, you know, the jadedness, is just all gone because of something Luke was able to pull off. And Luke surpassed the teacher, you know. As far as sacrifice and redemption is concerned, Luke surpassed Obi-Wan, which, you know, that's another, you know, moment of pride there for Obi-Wan. You know, his student has gone on and become better than he could hope. And in doing so, redeemed his best friend. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall there in the netherworld of the Force as Obi-Wan and Anakin reunited and, you know, were able to mend bridges.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think Obi-Wan is humbled a bit by Luke. You know, Luke proved him wrong. To Obi-Wan, Anakin was past redemption, but Luke proves him wrong. And, you know, of course we don't hear him say anything in that last scene on, you know, Endor when he appears to Luke and whatnot, but you can see the happiness. He's literally glowing. thank you for laughing at that. That was lame.
You know.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, I mean, what we've seen, though, is we've seen Obi-Wan, who's constantly been somebody who's, his whole life has been defined by finding the will of the Force for himself and for the galaxy at large, and Obi-Wan has done everything he could. And I think this last scene with Obi-Wan is Obi-Wan can finally rest. His best friend is redeemed. The Force has been brought back into balance. You know, and it's yippee. It's a happy ending. Obi-Wan can finally rest, which I think he has deserved. Just as Yoda says it, you know, in Return of the Jedi, you know, earned it I have. I think Obi-Wan is somebody also in that category. He has finally earned his peace and quiet.
Indeed, indeed. You know, as Yoda puts it, you know, rest, forever sleep. Earned it, I have. Well, my voice cracked there. Even worse than Yoda's voice cracking. Gosh. But yes, you know, forever sleep, earned it, I have. You know, it's time where Obi-Wan no longer has to make sure that things are taken care of. That torch, that mantle has been passed on to Luke. Luke has surpassed him. Luke has the tools and the ability and the drive to carry that on. Obi-Wan's journey is finished, and he can rest and enjoy his peace and quiet. And that is that. All's well that ends well.
Yeah, I think there's... And that's it. That's all I have to say about Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yes, indeed.
But yeah, that's
very... very interesting character, very iconic character, and one that I would love to be able to become like in my elder years, you know, be referred to as Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wit, wisdom, and sexy British. But anyway, yeah, that's all I have to say. Anything more for you, Jason?
That's it. I think we've pretty well wrapped that topic up.
Absolutely. So, before we go, we want to again introduce our next lightsaber matchup. Jason has posted on Facebook, and I assume his Twitter as well. I'm not as good with the Twitter account as Jason. But we would love some recommendations from you guys for our next episode, and we have yet to pick our next episode, so I'm sure we'll be doing that in the next few days, but we've gotten a few responses from some of you, so if there's anything you'd like to hear us discuss, you know what we're capable of doing, and maybe what we're not capable of doing, which would be nothing, because we're amazing.
Exactly!
But, you know, give us some of your input, but that's enough about that, so Jason, why don't you go ahead and introduce our next lightsaber matchup?
Alright, this lightsaber matchup, I'm hoping... does not end in another landslide unanimous victory. I don't think it will, but it might. I don't know. This matchup pits Jedi Knight Aayla Secura against Darth Talon, another Sith from the Legacy comics. They both happen to be female Twi'leks, so that will be a very interesting duel to find out. I have to do research on Darth Talon before I make my decision because I read the comics like 4 or 5 years ago once, and I have forgotten a lot of that, so I need to go back and get those little gray cells to remember that before I'm able to make my decision. But that, Aayla Secura versus Darth Talon, very curious to see your response to that, and looking forward to reading your responses on the next episode of The Wampa's Lair.
As am I, and I'm with you, Jason. I got to do a little bit of research myself on this next lightsaber matchup. I know Aayla Secura pretty well, but Darth, say the name again?
Darth Talon.
Darth Talon. I'm going to have to do some reading because I don't even really know who that is. but yeah, we'll be interested to see your input for the next episode. So again, for those of you who don't know as of yet, you can find us on Twitter at Wampa's Lair. You can certainly email us at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com. And if you haven't done so yet, please be sure to like us on Facebook at Wampa's Lair Podcast. A little spoiler alert, we should be getting some updated artwork very soon from the venerable Joe Hogan. More to come on that in the near future. So that's it for me. Jason, if you would do the honors as you always do.
All right, everybody, thank you very much once again for listening to the Wampa's Lair Podcast. This has been Episode 13, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Part 2. I am Jason Hunt, and for Carl LeClaire, we will see you next time in the Wampa's Lair.